taking care of your mental health, especially during these stressful times. According to the National Institute of Mental Health, there are 40 million adults in the U.S. who suffer from anxiety disorders, and most of them do not receive professional help, even though anxiety disorders are highly treatable. How do you know if you or someone you love might have an anxiety disorder? Or perhaps another common mental health problem, such as seasonal affective disorder or insomnia? I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we turn to two highly respected psychiatrists to answer your mental health questions. How do signs of psychiatric issues differ in children and older people? How can you distinguish between regular mood swings and something more serious, such as seasonal affective disorder? Is there really such a thing as narcissistic personality disorder? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Sources of stress and anxiety seem to be all around us these days. Look at a newspaper, watch TV news, or even go to a favorite social media site, and you're likely to hear about political upheaval, natural disasters, or a new health scare. What is all this worrying do to our psyche? Today, I have two experts with me to answer that and your other mental health questions. In the studio with me, Dr. Robin Ostrander. She is medical director of the Division of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry at Maine Medical Center, and she's chair of the Glickman Family Center for Child and Adolescent Psychiatry at Spring Harbor Hospital. And Dr. Charles Reynolds is a distinguished professor of psychiatry at the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine. As always, we want to hear from you. Are you concerned about feeling anxious or depressed this time of year? Does someone you know have trouble functioning this time of year? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Dr. Ostrander, welcome back to Maine Calling. Dr. Reynolds, welcome to Maine Calling. It's so terrific to have such all-stars in the studio with me. And I'll start with you, Dr. Reynolds. I want to talk about this idea of news-induced anxiety. The current political climate is causing a lot of people to feel anxious or stressed. How are these feelings the same or different from actual anxiety disorders?
I've rarely seen a time of greater uncertainty, Jennifer, than we're now seeing in our country. And that's certainly reflected in the stories that many of my older patients tell me. I'm a geriatric psychiatrist and work with older adults who have issues with anxiety and depression. And I think the general tenor of uncertainty in our times contributes a great deal to the felt stress and anxiety levels that many of my patients experience. And it does impair their functioning. It may get in the way of sleep and certainly can get in the way of enjoying life and get in the way of relationships with other people. But the stress levels are indeed very high at this point.
I understand that some of the signs or symptoms of anxiety in older adults may be different than those in people in their middle age or younger. Tell me, what are some of the differences? What are maybe some of the signs that a loved one of yours has anxiety that's beyond the normal feelings that one ought to be able to cope with on a day-to-day basis?
I think there is a great tendency among older adults to experience anxiety physically in terms of muscle tension or headache or inability to sleep. At the same time, they may experience worry, just as do younger people, younger adults, for example. But certainly the tendency to experience anxiety with respect to physical symptoms is very prominent among the older adults that I see. The same may also be true in the way that older adults experience depression.
Physical symptoms.
Physical symptoms, that's right.
Dr. Ostrander, how do you see anxiety in younger people? What are some of the symptoms and signs that you want parents or teachers or loved ones to be looking out for?
Well, the first thing I often try to let parents know is what's a normal worry, because normal worries change as children age. If anyone remembers being one or has children, you know that, you know, infants are startled at loud noises. At a certain age, they become fearful of strangers. They get scared of the dark or imaginary creatures. And a little bit older, they're afraid of earthquakes and natural disasters or something happening to their family. So all of those things are normal as long as they're not to an intensity that is really over and above what the child can manage, and they are not interfering. So that type of anxiety could become something that looks like a disorder if, for example, the child can't make friends, can't go to preschool without their parents, can't sleep at night, or the family finds itself having limited options about how to conduct their family because of the symptoms one person has. They can all sort of get in this sort of atomic situation where the child's in the middle of the atom and everyone's sort of circling around doing what they need to do to make it okay. So I often will ask parents to say, well, what's happening in your family, as well as what are you seeing in your child that you're concerned about?
I think as clinicians, Jennifer, as Dr. Ostrander was saying, we have to make judgment about the extent of distress and impairment that particular symptoms may be causing in an older adult or in a child, as the case may be. And it's within that context that we're called upon as medical professionals to make diagnoses, to offer treatment recommendations when things go well beyond what might be expected.
I learned this morning that something like 18% of Americans probably have some sort of anxiety disorder. Many people don't know that they do. Many people are not seeking help for that. What kind of advice can you give people for self-help? Maybe they're in rural Maine and don't have access to the kind of care they might need, or for some reason there's some inhibition to receiving that. Maybe there's not health care coverage. Are there things that if somebody is feeling some of the symptoms you've been talking about, they can do to help?
I agree with you that anxiety disorders are probably the most prevalent of any of the mental disorders that as mental health professionals we see. It may be helpful for someone living with an anxiety disorder to seek help from their primary care physician. In fact, many people would prefer to seek mental health services through a primary care physician or through a pediatrician rather than necessarily being referred to a mental health specialist. There may be also some lifestyle decisions that someone can make that can be helpful to lowering the levels of tension and stress and may help someone to manage symptoms of anxiety. There are also good psychotherapeutic approaches to learning self-management skills for anxiety disorders as well.
Okay, and some of the self-management, would that include trying to exercise? Trying to stop and breathe deeply, the things that our grandmothers told us to do.
Your grandmother was right.
I'm going to change the subject here a little bit. Dr. Ostrander, how common is seasonal affective disorder, I say, as we're between two winter snowstorms in February, Maine?
Well, there are some who might say that seasonal affective disorder is just a type of depression. And you often will have folks who will describe depressive symptoms, maybe off and on at different points in the year, but it is a noted difference that may have something to do with seasonal rhythms or hormones or the amount of light, the latitude we live at. There are certainly differences across countries based on latitude, we think, or the length of the day. But, you know, I don't have a number on the top of my head, honestly, to tell you how common it is, because I think it's perhaps underdiagnosed. And there is this overlap with what you might just consider hibernation. There are people who will recognize that in the wintertime, they maybe put on a few pounds, which they then lose in the spring. They want to kind of hunker down and eat carbohydrates and get cozy and read a book. And maybe they sleep more. Maybe they're actually a little more irritable. All of those things could be wrapped up in a depression that's happening during that time of year and maybe happens each time. That being said, there are people who clearly recognize, I know several, who, for example, will only take antidepressant treatment during the winter months and then stop it in the spring. They just simply don't need it the rest of the year. And then when they get to the point where they may be in the cohort that Dr. Reynolds sees, they may become snowbirds, move to a warm climate where they are throughout the year, and don't have seasonal depression anymore. So there's something happening there. Absolutely.
Okay. And Dr. Reynolds, let me ask you this. Does light therapy work? Have there been studies? And this is what we've heard about, where people are exposing themselves to a certain amount of a certain kind of light every day. I think it originated in Scandinavia. Do you recommend
it? I think there's good evidence that light therapy does work. I think bright light does several things that are helpful to us. First, it helps us to wake up. Secondly, it gives us a sense of well-being. It helps to reset our circadian rhythms. And I think also there's good evidence that light therapy does have a mood-elevating effect and an antidepressant effect.
Does it have to be a certain kind of light?
Yes. This is well known from clinical studies that very bright light, typically on the order of 2,000 lux or greater, to use the measurement units that are used in these studies, is necessary to have a therapeutic effect. And very often the timing of exposure to bright light is important as well for producing a sense of well-being in people living with winter depression. So we generally will recommend morning exposure to bright light.
We're talking with two highly respected psychiatrists. If you'd like to join the conversation, if you have questions for them, our phone number 1-800-399-3566, our email talk@mainepublic.org. You can tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. Let's talk about sleep disorders. It seems to me, Dr. Ostrander, we've been hearing more and more about these. Are more and more people being diagnosed? Is there more awareness? Or are more people having problems than before?
Well, the awareness is certainly increasing, and I think that many listeners, if not all of them, could make a list of the things that they're supposed to do to sleep better. It may be difficult to do some of those things. They may have to do with what type of work hours we are required to work. There's a robust evidence base around sleep disorders resulting from shift work, night shift, or shifts that change. There's also a lot of caffeine influence, other substances that influence our ability to sleep, and frankly, our own perceptions about how much sleep we ought to need. That sleep need is different for different people, but it also changes throughout your lifespan as you age in a more general way. And many of us would like to think that we only need 6.5 or 7 hours of sleep, but we're not those lucky folks at the end of the curve. We're actually closer to the middle, and we actually need 8. So not getting the sleep that you need over time does seem to have some cumulative effect. It can affect things like weight. It certainly affects things like cardiovascular disease and respiratory disease and hormones. So although we don't necessarily know everything about why we sleep, we know that we must.
What about people who have trouble sleeping, are aiming for those 8 hours and can't seem to get them? Can sleep disorders go away completely with proper treatment?
Well, sleep disorders are very, very treatable. We think about disorders of insomnia, disorders of excessive sleepiness, behavioral disturbances that can occur during sleep. And we also think about sleep disorders that represent circadian rhythm types of disorders. The key point, and I think Dr. Ostrander put her finger on it, is appropriate diagnosis of the complaint. What are the contributing factors, and how might they be addressed in an appropriate way? But I would say that certainly the most prevalent are insomnia disorders across the life cycle, more prevalent with increasing age. We tend not to recognize as a society disorders of excessive sleepiness, and yet sleepiness during the day can also be an incapacitating symptom and can put someone in harm's way, for example, if they're trying to drive a car. And each of these types of complaints needs to be appropriately evaluated in order to put the odds in the patient's favor.
Go ahead.
I was wondering if I could add something. There are many common ways to improve your odds of a good night's sleep, even if we know that the reasons why we're not sleeping well are varied and need exploration. But maintaining a consistent schedule, so having your Saturday-Sunday schedule be the same as when you wake up and go to bed during the week, reducing blue light flickering, emitting screens from hitting your eyeballs in the evening hours.
iPhones, iPads, sleep. Laptops, televisions.
Everything. Yeah, everything. You know, I often talk to parents, and it can be a real big struggle. So it's not something that necessarily can be done without input from all constituents and stakeholders. But no screens after dinner can be very helpful for people who find it hard to settle. Having the same bedtime routine, even if you're an adult, it doesn't mean that you need to be flexible and spontaneous. You can do the same thing every night, which gives your brain this clue, oh, we're going to sleep soon. Many people will say, only use your bed for sleeping. Don't watch TV. Don't read exciting books. Read exciting books somewhere else, because your brain needs to be excited in that chair over there, not in the place where you're supposed to settle. There's things about the room. Sometimes people need rooms to be utterly and completely dark. They put tape around the windows. They cover the little power strips, you know, orange light with a piece of duct tape. Room should be cool. Hmm. Room should be quiet. So there are many things, and the list goes on and on. And we actually at Maine Medical Center have been increasingly getting requests for people who wish to have therapy to train them to go to sleep. There's not necessarily very new, but there's a literature on cognitive behavioral approaches to sleep disorders, which are not rocket science, but do need the support of someone else, because it asks people to do that are difficult to maintain and are challenging. There are, as Dr. Reynolds said, many very, very well effective ways of treating insomnia.
So let me ask you about the sleep schedule in teenagers. If your teenager does not, in your judgment as a parent, get enough sleep during the week, but can sleep till 11 or noon on Saturday and Sunday, is that a good idea? Are they catching up? Or does one wake up one's teenager at 6:30 as they do for school?
Well, you know, it may be something you have to do an experiment with your own child to determine what gives you better results, the wake up or the let them sleep. But some of that is really looking at what's happening during the week that's limiting their sleep. And how do you make decisions about what's important? So kids are quite scheduled now into the evenings. Are they able to have enough time to get their homework done and still get to bed at a reasonable hour? And what time does their school begin? School districts are starting to clue in to the fact now that teenagers would probably do very well if school started around 10 and finished around 6. And some school districts have done this to great benefit.
Some, but not most.
No, not most. It disrupts lots of people, like the people who work there and who drive the bus and who run the sports programs and things like that. But even when you look at things like suicide attempts and self-injury and drug abuse, it often happens in the after-school hours when children are unsupervised before parents arrive at home. And if instead their free time without parents is from 8 to 10 in the morning, they aren't actually getting into any trouble. They're just sleeping. And then by the time they would get home from school, their parents would be home. So there are inherent benefits, although it's quite a sort of a big shift. It's a disruptive innovation to think about that change.
We do have to go to a break. Our phone number again, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Our email, talk@mainepublic.org. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Maine Senior Guide, an online resource of senior services and information for adult children, boomers, and beyond. More at MaineSeniorGuide.com.
The election of Donald Trump and the vote for Brexit surprised a lot of people, but writer Pankaj Mishra says they were a long time coming.
What we forgot is that this experience of great economic disruptions, people being laid off, jobs disappearing, all this has led to a lot of uncertainty.
I'm Kelly McEvers, explaining the age of anger this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
And you can join Nora Flaherty for All Things Considered this afternoon beginning at 4 o'clock. Work continues to improve the ways you can listen to Maine Public Classical. Ellsworth, Blue Hill, MDI, Machias, and Downeast area listeners are now enjoying our newest Maine Public Classical FM signal, 93.7 Millbridge MDI, a strong signal that also reaches inland and down the coast quite a bit. Also, if you're in Portland or surrounding communities and haven't recently tried our Maine Public Classical FM signal, 104.1, give it another try. We've made a few adjustments to bring Maine Public Classical to a larger area. You may now find that 104.1 FM works for you. And if you stream Maine Public Classical live at mainepublic.org on your desktop, tablet, or Apple or Android device, we've now added a new higher quality stereo stream. Enjoy.
And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, Answers to Your Mental Health Questions. With me in the studio, Charles Reynolds. He's a distinguished professor of psychiatry at the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine. And Robin Ostrander is medical director of the Division of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry at Maine Medical Center. We invite you to join the conversation. 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. Dr. Reynolds, one of your research areas focuses on complicated grief. Can you explain what that is and how it differs from regular grief?
About 10% of folks who have lost a loved one have difficulty accepting the loss and moving on with life and continue to grieve acutely, often for many years. And it's this that we refer to when we say complicated grief. It's a grief that won't die, essentially, and it can go on for many years. And typically, in the course of normal grief, people are able to come to terms with the loss and to envision a life, a future, without the loved one. And typically, that journey, if you will, from acute grief to what we think of as integrated grief, lasts 6 to 12 months, although it can vary a great deal. But when people get stuck, when they're unable to move forward with the work of grief, we've come to use the term complicated grief to describe that experience.
Just hearing you describe it makes me so sad for those people. It must be horrible.
You know, as a clinician, I have rarely, if ever, sat with patients whose anguish was deeper, whose suffering was greater than what I see in people living with prolonged, disabling grief. It is something that we are coming to recognize as not rare and something for which there do exist appropriate treatments that can be quite helpful to help people move along with their lives.
Robin, how does grieving affect young people differently than older people?
Well, in many ways, and often it depends on the age of the child at the time of loss and, of course, the type of loss. So for a child, losing a parent is a much more significant loss than when I often will ask clients and they'll say, well, I lost a dog or I lost a great-grandparent, which are just relationships that are important but not nearly to the degree. So the loss of a parent is an incredible loss at any age, even for us as adults. But children also may lose their protector. They also lose the developmental kind of training and coaching that their parent needed to provide, and there may or may not be other people still around in the sphere of that child who are as dedicated to that child to provide that nurturing and developmental push to get them to where they need to go. Often children also, by virtue of kind of what stage of their thinking they're at, will have sometimes very magical or very distorted ideas about what caused the loss. Sometimes they will blame themselves. Sometimes they will come up with a story that, frankly, doesn't help them make sense and move forward.
All right. We're going to go to Herb, who's calling from Gorham. Hi, Herb. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi. I'm a healthcare professional myself. I work in emergency. And you were talking about sleep and how that affects the lay person or everybody in general, you know, working the off shifts. And I just wanted to know what your take is on people in our profession in terms of healthcare, especially in emergency departments and whatnot, how we handle stress and working those off shifts. What do you recommend? What do you think is best for us to kind of get through those tough times and go from there? I know sleep is always kind of an issue in general, but, you know, where do you come from that and thoughts on that? I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
One thing I might start with, Herb, thank you, it's a really good question, is that there is this architectural field that looks at daylighting and creating a healing environment, especially in hospitals, both for patients and staff. So there are ways to design an emergency room that allows light to be as if you were in the daytime if it's the time that you need to be awake, so maybe in the middle of the night. And so, you know, institutions can put time and effort into creating surroundings that have a benefit of helping the circadian rhythms and sleep, potential sleep disorders of their clients, of their staff, but also creating a more honestly calming environment for the patients. There are a couple of things as far as shift workers or working off shifts. One is that if you, for example, are working nights on your days off, to continue on that night schedule is better, you know, in quotes, for how your physiology works. Although many people will say, well, I actually want to be awake on the weekends because my kids are home or whatever my off hours are. I need to go to the dentist. They don't have, you know, 1 a.m. dental appointments. So they are forced to be shifting each week from nights, days, nights, days, nights, days. Another way that's helpful if you're the one who sets the schedule is that staying on one shift like nights for several months in a row is much healthier than switching every week or every 2 weeks or every month. And it's often not the most popular, but there are ways to incentivize. Often there's a differential pay for people working the night shift or folks who even might choose it. But that can be very helpful as well.
And I'm thinking about Dr. Reynolds, that, you know, the man who called is a healthcare worker, but there's so many industries in this state, whether it's healthcare, whether it's tourism, whether it's fishing, whether it's agriculture, where people are not working Monday through Friday, 9 to 5.
Yeah. I would add only to what Dr. Ostrander said, Herb, that several years ago, there was a report from the Institute of Medicine that deals with issues of sleep deprivation in healthcare workers and medical professionals, which you might want to take a look at, because there are a number of specific recommendations in that report about the timing of work and the amount of work that can be safely done in the course of a week before medical errors begin to increase. So it's a very important topic.
I'm going to go to Mary, who wrote in from Facebook. What types of therapy do you recommend for a child who is 12 who has sleep disturbance, falling to sleep, ADHD, depression, and anxiety? Any natural therapy besides medication? We are looking into a weighted blanket.
Ah, well, weighted blankets are something that was really developed in the occupational therapy community and is used for people with sensory issues, autism. And there is quite a bit of literature that you should not sleep with it.
Hmm.
So it is, in general, the danger is that you will stop breathing. So having a heavy blanket on your body while you're sleeping is actually not a safe idea. It is something that perhaps a child could have with them to help them fall asleep, only if the parent has a fail-safe method for going in and taking that blanket shortly after the child falls asleep. So there's that piece. There are multiple ways, and it does matter, and it also doesn't matter what anxiety, depression, ADHD, what struggles a child's dealing with. You can do all the same things to help them and any other child fall asleep. So some of the things are the ones I mentioned around the quality of the room, caffeine, screens. There are many mindfulness techniques that children sometimes are better at learning than adults, and I really like to teach them. I think we talked about them the last time I was here. Jennifer, one of them I like to teach. A child who's 12 is a little bit old for this one, but it's called the breathing buddy. So you take your little stuffy, as they call them in Maine, and you put it on your chest, and you lie on your back, and you watch the stuffed animal go up and down. It's not inherently easy for children to understand when they're inhaling and exhaling. You've seen many kids who don't know how to breathe in through their nose and out through their mouth. the Breathing Buddy can teach. And there are multiple other ways to teach mindfulness. You could even check on a search engine, mindfulness for children, and you'll see multiple things you can teach them.
I'm going to go to CJ, who is living in Montreal, but wants to let us know he's from Maine. Hi, CJ. Go ahead.
Hi, good afternoon. I'm calling because I don't know where else to turn. I have a brother who was diagnosed more than 30 years ago with schizophrenia. He was in a number of programs in the state of Maine, and I think because of some lack of health care, he had some health issues and has been living in a nursing home ever since then with a number of very serious health issues. I recently found out that he is basically dying and there is a DNR in place. And I tried to ask the state of Maine, who is his guardian, to lift that, and they won't. Is there any way to intervene on a patient who has these kinds of serious mental health issues and who's basically dying in order to try and lift the DNR?
That's an interesting question, CJ. I'm not sure our panel, do you all know the answer to that, or is that a call for somebody like the Attorney General's office?
I'm sure that there are folks with legal expertise that far exceeds mine, certainly. Often there are ways when a guardian is appointed to a person who's been determined not to have capacity to make decisions, that there is a way to question the judgment of that guardian. So an attorney probably would be helpful at looking at what is the process if a family member disagrees with a legal guardian's medical decision, and look into it from that perspective.
Good luck to you, CJ. We're going to go to Sally, who's calling from Auburn. Hi, Sally. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi. Thank you. My question is if you recognize a personality disorder, or what you think, I'm not a professional in that, but I think I have a child with narcissism. How do you approach them, or how do you talk to them about it?
How old is your child?
21.
Okay, so a young adult. Well, we haven't talked much about personality disorders and what is the difference between a disorder and just a personality style, or really what the definition of narcissism is. So it might make some sense to pull back a little and define those. But there is a sense of narcissism, meaning a love of oneself, that is essential and necessary to life, to health. And then there are currently really under revision ways of looking at when does that become a disorder and what does it look like. So one of the things that I've had most success with teenagers is openness. And I have actually given the book, the special secret psychiatry book that shows what we might consider a disorder, and given it to the client and said, look at this and tell me what you think of this. Does any of this apply to you? And sometimes that if you have a relationship with someone, they can then say, yeah, I do these things. And then you can have a discussion about how that gets in the way, how it might impact other people, how it impacts them, what their thoughts and fears are about it, and then make some even small bit of shared understanding about how to move forward, maybe in just one situation, and then build on those successes.
Dr. Reynolds, you specialize in geriatrics. If somebody has a personality disorder and has had that personality disorder for 60, 70 years, is it particularly difficult to get through to them?
I've been very interested, Jennifer, in how longstanding personality issues interact with common mental disorders like depression and complicate the treatment. And what we and others have observed is that if we can adequately treat, say, anxiety or depression in an older adult, then the personality style, the personality disorder, may get better. The two interact in a way that makes it particularly problematic for older adults to function. So we like to focus, as does Dr. Ostrander, on what is treatable, what can be helped, whether it be in an adolescent or in an older adult, because we're able to do considerable good.
Interesting. Yeah. And that's probably great relief to some who are talking about their husband or wife or mother or father.
It's relief not only, I think, to the person affected, but to those who give them care.
Wow. Well, we're going to take another short break. When we return, more of your comments and questions for Dr. Reynolds and Dr. Ostrander. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Evergreen Home Performance, offering energy-efficient windows and insulation to help homeowners achieve year-round comfort. More at evergreenyourhome.com. And University of New England, online and on campuses in Portland, coastal Biddeford, and Tangier, Morocco. une.edu.
Intelligence Squared US, where the world's leading thinkers debate today's most critical issues. The next topic up for debate: give Trump a chance.
Barack Obama insisted on getting a chance as a newly elected president. Elections have consequences, he said. I won.
The core premise is that we do not yet have sufficient information to form a judgment, but we do.
And that program coming up after Maine Calling at 2 o'clock.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Andrew Refkin, senior reporter for climate and related issues at ProPublica, about how the Trump administration is responding to climate issues. Refkin has been reporting on global environmental issues for over 30 years. We'll also talk about the stroke he had in 2011 and how being a science writer affected how he processed what was happening. Join us.
Join us for Fresh Air this evening at 7 o'clock.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, research recommendations from the world of mental health. In the studio with me, Robin Ostrander. She is medical director of the Division of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry at Maine Medical Center. And Charles Reynolds is distinguished professor of psychiatry at the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine. Join our conversation. Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. That phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Before the break, we were talking a little bit about this idea of having a personality disorder, whether it's narcissism or something like that. What is a personality disorder? Is it the same thing or is it a different thing than a diagnosable illness such as depression or schizophrenia? What's the difference, Dr. Ostrander?
Well, as a child and adolescent psychiatrist, I often live in the world of avoiding creating diagnoses that are considered to be lifelong, because I feel like one of my roles is to find out what is stuck, unstick it so that a child can get back on their developmental trajectory and potentially not need the services of mental health providers anymore. Or maybe just come back once in a while for a tune-up. So I am hardly an expert in the areas of personality disorders. And I would echo what Dr. Reynolds said earlier, which is when someone is presented as or described as having a potentially developing personality disorder based on their behaviors or their way of interacting in relationships, if we treat an illness like depression, often those other things that are considered really part of them go away and they're clearly part of the depressive disorder. So, for example, something like irritability or self-harming behavior can simply cease when depression goes into remission. So it's really important to tease that apart.
And just to echo that, Jennifer, in my older adults, very often I will see dependency, dependent behaviors, avoidant behaviors, which might be ascribed to a personality disorder, but which are in reality behavioral manifestations of a treatable mental illness like depression.
Mm. This is a related question. Heather, on Facebook, how common is a misdiagnosis between physical ailments and mental conditions, understanding that depression and other mental disorders cause physical symptoms, thinking specifically about Lyme disease and such, where the tests are controversial? Boy, this is what we kind of started the program talking about a little bit.
I think misdiagnoses, in fact, are common, in part because we don't screen for depression on a regular or systematic basis. If we do, I think the odds of appropriately diagnosing depression, even in the context of a medical disorder like Lyme disease or congestive heart failure, are greatly increased. We know that there are specific symptoms of depression, for example, that differentiate it from the more nonspecific symptoms that can be seen in common medical disorders. So it's a question of screening in part that can then lead to appropriate diagnosis and treatment.
Isn't that interesting that we don't screen? Because we screen for mammogram, breast cancer with mammograms, we have colonoscopies, But we began this program by talking about 18% of Americans likely have an anxiety disorder, but it's not part of your screening.
Well, it's noteworthy, I think, Jennifer, that the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force is now advocating regular screening for common mental disorders like depression as a part of primary care. And so Dr. Ostrander and I, as mental health professionals, welcome such recommendations across the life cycle in pediatric medicine and in general adult medicine.
In general, people would, I think, avoid screening because they felt like they didn't have treatment to offer, or they felt like they didn't have access to a specialist. So one of my jobs as a child and adolescent psychiatrist is work with pediatricians, which I do quite often. I go to pediatric practices and just give them the skills that I have and answer their questions about the children they serve, who often don't need to come and see me, but maybe they just need some suggestions. So I also work with behavioral health clinicians, mainly social workers, who work in pediatric primary care practices. So they may be doing therapy or mental health evaluations for kids seen in that pediatric office. So they will come to me and present a story and get feedback to me. So there are multiple ways in which mental health expertise can be then sort of moved into the realm of primary care, which I think will then help people feel better about doing screening, because then they feel like they have something really powerful to offer when they pick out someone with depression.
I do exactly the same, Jennifer, at the other end of the life cycle in dealing with older patients and trying to be of help to my colleagues in primary care medicine.
We're going to go to John in Searsport. Hi, John. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you. Myself and my daughter both had issues of anxiety, and I had issues of depression. And the things I found most useful was not any medical evaluation, but I went to a marriage counselor who suggested that I meditate, and he gave me a tape to use to do that. And I found that meditation really allowed me to relieve the anxiety and the depression. And then the other thing that I did with my daughter was guided meditation. She was about 6 years old when she was diagnosed with ADD, and it just seemed to really work magic. That and a combination of improved diet, a more alkali-based diet, balancing our pH and our bodies, that really seemed to make the huge difference. I just wanted to make that comment and see if that was something that the esteemed guests think might be worthwhile.
Interesting, John. And we have done Maine Calling programs on the benefits of meditation, but I haven't ever heard the second part, the alkaline-based diet. Is that something you all are familiar with?
There are almost too many different dietary approaches to keep track of. And nutrition is woefully undertaught in medical school. So in general, my clients know much more about nutrition because it's something that's been that important to them that they have researched it themselves than I do. So over the years, I've come to learn a lot. And I think that there are many things we don't understand about how the digestive system, the immune system, hormonal systems are all modulating each other to both create and ameliorate mental health symptoms. So really, if you find things that appear to be helping, they probably are helping. And if your child or you are able to then function better, and no one's telling you that you're doing something that has an unforeseen benefit, like liver failure of a herb that you're using might be an example, then why not? There is no one prescription. And I think within the mindfulness techniques that we touched on earlier, meditation is very important and should be taught to children. And if you learn it to teach it to your children, then you'll learn it for yourself as well.
Agreeing with Dr. Ostrander, John, I think your experience also illustrates that many folks learn self-management techniques, some of which are mindfulness-based, others of which are based in relaxation. But the important thing is that you have learned techniques that seem to serve you and your family member well.
We'll move on. We'll go to Creighton calling from Falmouth. Hi, Creighton. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hello. I wanted to just say something about support for family members. The mother who called before asking about her 21-year-old son. And I have done a lot with advocacy work around mental health issues in Maine. And I know from personal experience how much it helps to be with other people who are going through similar things. So I just wanted to let people know that the National Alliance on Mental Illness has a chapter here in Maine, and wherever you live in Maine, you can contact them, and they can let you know about family support groups. And this can be incredibly helpful when a young person is newly diagnosed with a significant brain disorder, and you're trying to come to terms with that, and especially around how to communicate with someone who's struggling with an active illness.
I couldn't agree more. Thank you so much for adding that.
Yeah, families are, we're asked to do a really big job, and we are willing to do it, but I often say when I talk to doctors, you know, we can undo all the good you've done in less than 48 hours because we have no idea what we're doing. So that's why I really want people to know about support groups for family members because it is really, it can be really traumatic for the whole family.
It's also been my privilege to work for many years with NAMI in Pittsburgh, and I could not agree more with the importance of what you're saying, that NAMI is a great organization that provides support for the families of those living with serious and persistent mental illness. Thank you for the work that you do, and thank you for the alliances that Dr. Ostrander and I as mental health professionals can form with you and other support groups.
Yes, thanks for your call, Creighton. And we'll post a link to NAMI Maine's website on our MPBN Maine Calling Facebook page at Maine Calling, you know, facebook.com/Maine Calling. But if you'd like to post anything to Creighton, that would be wonderful. We have just a few minutes left, and I think I want to end that by asking both of you, and I'll start with you, Dr. Reynolds. In your time, in your career, and in your in the studies that you've done of older Americans, if you work with grief, have there been any changes that are so important and so dramatic that you want to make sure people understand that? Something that was, you know, maybe if your patient's 70 years old, something that was given a given when they were 40 that now is completely changed?
I think the attitudes about depression in older adults have changed dramatically. Over the last 30, 40 years, we used to accept depression as a normal part of growing old. We now recognize that it is a treatable medical disorder, that there are good treatments that work, and that people and families should avail themselves of those treatments. It makes a difference.
Because it really can be harmful when people are locked into a way of thinking, believing that something is the truth, believing that something like, oh, that's just what happens when you age.
Exactly. Exactly. That kind of fatalism simply is not supported by medical science. There have been some pretty dramatic changes in the way we approach the treatment of depression across life cycle, both in the work that Dr. Ostrander does and in the work that I do. And there's lots of reason for hope.
And I'll put the same question to you, Dr. Ostrander. What do you want people to know? What untruth do you want to undo right now on Maine Calling?
Well, I'm so honored to be here in the hopes that maybe one family who has the sense, or even parents have the sense, that there is something really not right, that my child is suffering or we as a family are suffering from what appears to be mental illness, and they're not certain whether it would be safe or okay to go see a mental health professional. So my hope is that they hear me talking and say, well, she seems like she's kind of nice. And it would be safe to go in and just get some information and then make a shared decision together about what to do next. We will not choose medication every time for every patient. We have multiple other things at our disposal, which we talked about today, as far as sleep hygiene or mindfulness meditation, exercise, light, that can be used to serve what a family wants to do and what they feel safe and comfortable with. So I just encourage, you know, folks to just come in and ask the questions, and we'll do our very best to give you choices about what to do next.
What do you say to people who are suspicious of the system, who are afraid if they bring their child somewhere, that they will be labeled, that that label will follow them, that it will somehow affect them in life?
It's so interesting because in some ways we all have ideas about what our children are going to be like. And so if we have a child who has a mental illness, like severe depression or obsessive compulsive disorder, for example, we don't want that child to be labeled. And yet, is it really that we just don't want that child to be ill? Of course we don't want our children to be ill. But if you correctly, I might say, diagnose something, then you have a chance to treat it and make it much less severe or even go away to the point where it's not affecting someone's life anymore. So yes, you may bring stigma upon your child and your family by openly seeking treatment, but you're actually getting the treatment. So you're maybe improving the life of the child. And then the other piece is for every one of us who tells our personal story to our friends or neighbors about how we sought and got mental health care for our kids and whether it helped, may it frankly just save lives, because many people die of untreated depression. So why not choose life over our own fear of being stigmatized?
You're nodding, Dr. Reynolds.
I agree completely. I think stigma is still an issue. But if we can talk honestly about our own experiences with getting treatment for mental illness, it can go a long way to being helpful to others.
Well, thank you both for being here today. What a wonderful hour. Dr. Charles Reynolds, Distinguished Professor of Psychiatry at the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine. He is now based here in Maine. Dr. Robin Ostrander, Medical Director of the Division of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry at Maine Medical Center. She is also chair of the Glickman Family Center for Child and Adolescent Psychiatry at Spring Harbor Hospital. Jonathan Woodward ran the board today. We had additional help from John Keimel. You can find past editions of Maine Calling, as well as a link to our audio archives at mainecalling.net. Today's show will be rebroadcast tonight at 8. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, Senator Angus King joins me for a conversation about his current priorities, including his views on President Trump's nominees and the latest news from the Senate Intelligence Committee on which he serves. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.